You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the open banking movement. Whether you're a financial expert, banking executive, or everyday consumer, open banking affects everyone and will change the way we interact with our money. I'm A.L. Savan, your host. This episode is brought to you by Ozone API, unlocking the power of open finance all over the world. The U.S. banking ecosystem is unlike any other. While there are a small number of giant banks at the head, just like everywhere else, what makes the U.S. landscape unique is its long tail. Shaped by a vast network of over 10,000 financial institutions, the sheer scale of U.S. banking is striking. The providers that make up the long tail come in all shapes and sizes, from community banks that serve just a handful of neighborhoods, to niche banks that focus on particular industries, to thousands of tiny credit unions formed by families or friends. Just like the big guys, the smaller banks need IT systems to make them go. And they likely don't have an army of engineers to build and maintain them. So they rely on specialized software vendors, known as core providers, who offer a sort of bank-in-a-box. The big guys use core providers too, but the little guys entirely depend on them. So for U.S. open banking to succeed, the cores have to be on board. While there is significant competition in the U.S. core provider market, it is largely dominated by the big three: FIS, Fiserv, and Jack Henry. Between them, these three power the vast majority of U.S. banks, making them critical players in modernizing the U.S. banking system. Whether that means digital transformation, real-time payments, or open banking. On this episode, recorded at Money 2020 in Las Vegas late last year, we sit down with the open banking leads from the big three to get their perspective on how the U.S. cores are preparing for the coming wave. On Mr. Open Banking Live. You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the evolution of open banking around the world. I'm your host, A.L. Savan, broadcasting live from the MoneyPot exhibit at the world's premier fintech event, Money 2020. For this session, I'm joined by three guests who are responsible for the open banking strategies at the largest core banking providers in the United States. There are many things that make the U.S. banking ecosystem unique. One is the sheer number of institutions, often estimated at around 10,000. Getting this ecosystem ready for open banking is nothing short of a Herculean task, and my three guests are right in the middle of it. Chad Killingsworth is the head of engineering at Jack Henry. Sunil Sachdev is the head of embedded finance at Fiserv. And Hashim Toussaint is the Senior Vice President of Digital and Open Banking at FIS. Let's begin. The three of you represent the three largest core banking providers in the United States. Between your three organizations, you provide banking capabilities not to tens of institutions or hundreds of institutions, but to thousands. Why don't you each take a moment to tell us a little bit about your organizations and perhaps what makes them different from each other?
Sure. Sunil Sachdev from Fiserv. We at Fiserv think of ourselves more as a commerce enabler than a core provider. And I think that's important given the subject matter today, or with regards to open banking. when you think about what we're living through in terms of the progression of financial services and the ability to service those use cases in a variety of interfaces that not necessarily live in a financial institution, but are tethered to a financial institution, I think what we're all hoping to achieve is to be able to deliver and enable commerce in new and unique ways, in especially given where the current demographic is more digitally native and looking to experience those capabilities through a digital interface. So again, at Fiserv, we kind of see ourselves as a commerce enabler at the nexus of financial institutions and merchants.
Well, now, yeah. So when I think about the FIS mission and vision, it is to unlock financial technology to the world. One of the reasons I joined FIS certainly is for the breadth of capabilities that we provide to the market, from core banking to money movement to wealth, retirement. And so we carved out digital and open banking into its separate business because we know that we have to support our customers in this new space, which really allows them to differentiate themselves and really grow their businesses by attracting new customers. So we certainly want to bring to bear all that we provide to the marketplace in a much more intuitive and simplified way going forward.
So Jack Henry's mission is to empower community and regional financial institutions in the United States, not globally, in the United States, to punch above their weight, to bring a technology solution that really empowers that local economy and that relationship with their. We have no plan B. There's no fallback. We are mutually invested with those companies to see them succeed, which gives us kind of a unique perspective on the whole open banking relationship. The U.S. market is wildly different than the rest of the world. And success here is critically important to small town America as well as to the large coastal cities. And Jack Henry helps those really small financial institutions as well as the regional ones succeed there in ways that most aren't even considering.
As you all know, on October 22nd, 2024, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, officially released their final personal financial data rights rule based on Section 1033 of the Dodd-Frank Act, the U.S. answer to open banking. From the perspective of a large core provider, is this rule a good thing or a bad thing?
I think the rule, its intent, is to help consumers have greater access to financial services, the ability to ensure that the data is being used in an appropriate manner and safeguarded at all times. And with that intent comes a whole lot of responsibility with regards to all of the entities in the supply chain that support the capabilities that these customers are looking for. So from that perspective, I think having a set of rules and guidelines to announce to everybody that we are taking consumer data protection seriously is important. I think having an even playing field where financial institutions and third parties understand each other's roles and responsibilities with regards to managing data in a much more open ecosystem is important. The rule book, however, is pretty thick, and it just came out. So there's a lot of things that I think will continue to be debated and continue to be tweaked as we all experience what the rollout plan will eventually look like.
Yeah, so there's no surprise, right? Mixed reviews in terms of the new ruling and what it means for all that participate in this ecosystem. Certainly, there is clear excitement in some corners around the ability to unlock new use cases and a new value prop for end users. And that's exciting for us as well. But there are real concerns, right? There are real concerns around data, right? The customer's data, how do we protect it? How do we transmit it securely? And also, customers truly understanding what they're signing up for. When you authorize your data to be shared, do you truly understand what that means? Both today, but also long-term as well. So there's also the customer sort of education element, which I think there are some concerns around. And then also, as you think about expanding this ecosystem of providers and players, ensuring that all the same standards around security and resilience are the same, that's also a big challenge, right, that we have to work together to figure out. But ultimately, to the point mentioned earlier, it's all about how do we empower the end user, right? How do we allow them to achieve their financial goals in a way that's seamless, intuitive, removes friction? That's the spirit of it, but obviously we need to work around some of the challenges to ensure that we create that environment for the users to be successful.
I'd agree that the intent is a good thing and the push towards more securely sharing data is a good thing. I think there's a really negative aspect of it. The regulation, though, is they saddled an immense compliance burden on financial institutions that, frankly, aren't the top 10, right? And so the idea that every financial institution out there, you mentioned 10,000 of them, right? They all having to do all of this due diligence on any recipient who comes and asks is almost ludicrous. Like, to the matrix of tens of thousands of fintech apps times 10,000 institutions and each one doing their own due diligence is not sustainable. Unfortunately, the CFPB just dropped that in the lap of the financial institutions and told them they can't charge for it. So it's just a cost of doing business. All that's going to do is end up hurting consumers because you're going to get lower rates on savings accounts because of that. That the money has to come from somewhere to cover that expense. And I just don't think that's well thought out.
The commercial aspect aside, the technological foundation of open banking is the adoption of what the CFPB calls standardized developer interfaces, but what are more commonly called APIs, application programming interfaces. All three of your organizations already have robust API strategies. How are these strategies affected by the new rule and the eventual standard that the CFPB selects, be it FDX or otherwise? Do you need to adjust your strategies, or are you already on track?
Yeah, I think for us, we've spent a lot of time, money, in building out robust APIs across a wide variety of products at Fiserv. These are products that support not only financial institutions, but as I mentioned earlier, enable commerce because they connect systems that support a variety of payment and money movement use cases that are not just leveraged by financial institutions, but by large and small merchants across the country. Money movement capabilities that also span geographic guidelines as well, or geographic territories, I should say. So I think from our perspective, we're continuing on that path to invest in those APIs to ensure there's ease of access, there's ease of compatibility in terms of looking at the data normalized in a single way, and then being able to facilitate those use cases as they come along.
I think for us, it really reinforces what we've been working on. We've spent the last year and a half building out a set of capabilities. One, to unify, and I talked about the breadth of solutions that we have across FIS. And so we're creating a banking layer to unify all of those solutions into a single layer where providers and banks can access through one entry point and leverage the breadth of what FIS brings to the table. We've also spent the last year building an open access product in preparation for the rule, which we've just went live with in the last couple of weeks. And again, this is really to allow aggregators to integrate easily into our system. And again, unlock the use cases that our banks need, both from a regulatory perspective, but also to compete in sort of this new world of open banking.
So Jack Henry's been working on APIs from the cores since 2006, and it's the foundation of everything we do there. It's not really a core issue at this point for any of us, honestly. Cores have had APIs for eons. That's how all digital banking works. Where this becomes interesting is open banking is really forcing the digital providers, which all of us in the room have, but there's a lot that aren't in this room that also have. They're the ones that now all of a sudden have to expose APIs out. The digital platforms are where the identity for the user lives, right? The cores are designed, almost every core in existence today was designed what we like internally call pre-internet, right? The authentication mechanism was you walked up to a counter and showed your driver's license. And all that. So the digital providers had to build identity authentication there. So open banking leverages that identity layer. So it's the open banking ecosystem on the digital side that's really going to have to shift here. And that's where a lot are not well prepared. However, Jack Henry's been working on this for our premium open banking product, the Banno platform, for years. Our first data access agreements were back 2019, I believe. And we've onboarded almost 1,000 institutions, which covers 12 million consumer users, to open banking on all major data platforms out there. And we're seeing great success. I mean, the stability of the platform has significantly increased. There's now an official support mechanism. So this customer has a problem on this platform, they can actually ask and we'll actually be able to troubleshoot and answer. Like, that didn't exist before. With screen scraping, it was a cold war. Like, yes, you're screen scraping us, but don't ask me for support. I don't support that. That's not my deal. So with this, there's a much more direct arrangement. And what we found is the support load internally has not increased dramatically. And so the outcomes for the consumers have only increased. And so it's been very positive. It's a lot of work to get there. But that API layer at the digital platform is what's empowering this. The cores have been there for a long time.
Okay.
I mentioned FTX. Let's double click on that. Although it has not been officially selected by the CFPB as the standard, all three of you are members of the Financial Data Exchange. The solutions that you describe, that you've already put in place, are they based on FTX? And if they are, have you embraced both the data standard side and the security framework side, or are you still on that journey?
Yeah, I would say for us, we're still on that journey. We definitely have solutions that reflect the FTX and IFX standards that are out there. We continue to work with protocols that are going to be widely adopted by the overall ecosystem, because that's kind of the essence of open banking, right? You want to be able to communicate in a language that the recipient is going to be able to accept, and have systems to be able to talk to each other through that standard protocol. So I think for us, whether it's FTX or another offshoot, we're ready, because again, as we've talked earlier, the API layers and the orchestration layers that we have built are quite pliable and flexible, right? We understand that the underlying data models and schemas in all of our different systems. So the ability to apply different types of protocols to communicate that data, I think for us, is pretty straightforward.
Yeah, so the banking platform layer I described, that is built to FTX standards with an FIS. We're also on the journey as well, right? That's one piece of the API ecosystem. We certainly have APIs from our core systems, from our money movement systems. And what we've recently done is, so we're also on the journey, right? But the layer that we will be exposing externally certainly is built within FTX standards. And we will continue to be active participants as, right, the standards evolve and really embracing sort of those standards going forward. We recently really put a lot more structure and leadership and process looking across all the APIs that we support and supply across all of our solutions, with the goal of making sure that internally we have a set of standards that are uniformed across the company. So we're very much on that journey as well. But I think for us, the layer that exposes the FIS capabilities and assets certainly are FTX, meet the FTX standard today.
So Jack Henry's has an API that predates FTX, and so we've been concentrating on rolling that out with the intent to adapt that to the FTX standard just as soon as the CFPB announces a standard-setting organization. We are following the security side of it, but not the data side. It's a well-thought-out standard and API, and I can't think of a better one. I definitely wouldn't suggest any other one out there to follow, but we haven't used that as well. Again, it will be, as everyone else is mentioning, it's not a hard task to change the data elements to a standard that's very similar. And so we're well prepared to do that. We're waiting on the final rule. Like, there's no need to go do work all the way back to Chorus to pull a new data element when you don't even know if it's going to be required yet or not. So that's kind of we're in that chicken and egg game, but we're ready to go with FTX as soon as it is announced as the standard setting organization.
Chad, you mentioned that Jack Henry is indeed following the security standard. In the case of FTX, the security framework document talks about support for FATB, specifically FATB 1 advanced with PAR. I don't want to get into the technical weeds too much, but in general, the OpenID Foundation has defined a number of security standards that have been largely embraced by open banking regimes all around the world. Although FTX has not released formal certification based on those standards yet, are your organizations embracing the OpenID Foundation path, or is that also part of the journey?
I think for us, it's also part of the journey, right? I think we recognize that there are open banking standards, as you mentioned, all over the world. Their intent and their outcomes are pretty much the same. How they get there are a little bit different. We have platforms that not only operate in the US, but are global platforms. So we need to account for that as we think about what the end outcome will be. And of course, we've always been an institution or a company that has stood by safety and soundness of the technology solutions that we support for the financial institutions that consume them. So I think for us, pretty much par for the course. It's a journey. We're going to look at what the standards come out final, what they look at finally, and then be able to support that.
Yeah, we're embracing the standards as well. As you can imagine, a company the scale of FIS, right? There are many solutions, many legacy solutions from years past that are still part of our ecosystem. I think for us, the first step was to first really bring in the types of leadership and leaders who truly understand what best of breed looks like, but also more importantly, implementing those solutions within our vast ecosystem. And we've done that both from a technology and product perspective. So we are also on the journey, but we are embracing really modern sort of constructs that really, again, help protect the firm, help protect our banks, but most importantly, truly help protect the end user and the customer.
Yeah, since you mentioned FAPI, I want to pick at that one a little bit. So Jack Henry uses the OpenID Connect specification and follows OAuth 2.1, the draft spec as well. But the FAPI part seems to be a fancy name. It has financial in the word, so people think, like, let's just apply it. The hardest part when you're onboarding someone to an API is getting that initial auth working, right? It is the biggest barrier, right? And the FAPI standard, while well-intended, increases that barrier by an order of magnitude. It's significantly harder than standard OAuth. And there's other ways to mitigate the risk that comes with OAuth 2, right? You can have shorter-lived access tokens. You can monitor for fraud and things like that. So we've been pushing very hard, not that we would like to support FAPI as an optional part, but not require it. And we may have a carrot and stick approach. So if you use FAPI, I'm going to give you a longer live access token and you get more performance and a better experience because you've lowered your risk and improved your technical prowess. And so I'll give you more on that. If you're not, I still want to support you there. And I want these smaller developers to be successful. And so if we use just standard OAuth 2.1, and OpenID Connect, I'm going to make you get an access token a lot more frequently to mitigate that risk, but I want them to be successful as well. I don't want to use a financial term. I don't want to price them out of the market, right? I want them access to my APIs as well. And that initial auth part is such a barrier. And so it's super important to us that barrier be as low as possible without increasing the risk beyond what we should. And so that's why we've pushed really hard to support both, but not to require FAPI.
If I might reflect that back, almost a tiered approach to security, quote unquote, certification, a kind of bronze, silver, gold. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And in the end result, you can do all the same things on the lower tiers, but on the higher tiers, you will get a more performant experience. And we want to push you to that higher tier as well, but we just don't want to require it out of the gate.
Let's switch gears. In the final rule, the CFPB significantly changed both the timeline for achieving compliance, as well as the tiering by asset size indicating which banks are in scope. Let's explore each of those changes in turn. First, the timeline. The largest providers now have until April 1st, 2026, and the tier behind them until 2027, but perhaps the most notable change for core providers, like yourselves, is for the smaller institutions. Between $10 billion and $3 billion in assets now have until April 1st, 2028. Between $3 billion and $1.5 billion have until April 2029, and the smallest covered institutions, those with under $1.5 billion in assets but more than $850 million, now have until April of 2030. Does this effectively push open banking to the back of the line in terms of priorities at your organizations, or is there still a sense of urgency?
I think for us, there is a sense of urgency. We talked at the top of the hour that commerce is changing. The reason for open banking is to enable customers to have third parties get access to their data in a secure and efficient and compliant manner. So I think from that perspective, whether you're a large financial institution, medium, small institution, you're going to be catering to customers that are leveraging third-party applications, leveraging commerce experiences that will require folks to get access to data. So I think while the CFPB has put in some guardrails to help financial institutions manage that upfront investment, I think ultimately the customers are going to decide that, hey, I need the experience when I need the experience. So for us, our goal is to ensure as the rules get finalized, whatever they might be, that we are able to support them across all financial institutions, regardless of asset size.
When I think about our sort of stance and what the discussions with our clients will be, whether you're a bank who needs to adopt the rule in 2026 or through 2030, or not at all in some cases, yes, there's a regulatory angle to this. By the way, open banking exists today, right? The rules just further help us define what it looks like. So it's here, and to the points earlier, it's driven by the end consumer. And this is more of a competition challenge versus a regulatory challenge. And our stance will be to adopt the standards sooner rather than later. When I think about ultimately what the banks are really challenged with is how do you compete for the next generation of consumer who is very different from today's generation? A couple of examples. We recently launched some research and published some research that shows that when you look at Gen Z and millennials, 40% of Gen Z, 36% of millennials get their financial advice from social media. 25% get that financial advice from their banks. So there is a conversation that's happening beyond a bank's purview. And they have to get engaged in that conversation, right? Banks still have a tremendous trust equity across consumers. And so that's a value add to be a big part of that conversation. That same group, however, has some of the highest levels of anxiety we've seen when you compare them to their parents and their grandparents. And so there's a real need for beyond the social media realm to help customers truly get a handle, create roadmaps to financial stability, create roadmaps to saving and investing. And banks play a major role in that. The other thing is tomorrow's consumer will have 5 to 7 providers that support them. That's just a fact. That's not going to change. And so having a much more fulsome view beyond the walls of the bank is incredibly important to compete and support those customers. So getting involved early, being part of the discussion and dialogue is really critical for our clients. And that's really the stance we're taking. Even though you might have time to comply, it's in your benefit to engage early.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all of that. The idea that you could push off compliance doesn't work in a competitive landscape, but it also does. So the idea that you can take the technical parts and for the really small FIs, go ahead and adopt that, that empowers those FIs to survive, right? If they don't know where their next customer is coming from, if they don't have a plan to move down the generational gap and grow up that in rural America, they're going to get acquired, right? They're going to cease to be their own thing, and they're just going to get sucked up into a larger FI. But those that actually do have a plan and a strategy and rooted in their community, even below 850 million, right? If we can empower them to have the technological side and they don't have to have the compliance side, that's great for them, right? They can reap the benefits of this entire ecosystem. Most of them are just going to be empowered by the data aggregators, which is fabulous, right? We're going to get all of these fintech apps for them. And they're not going to have to worry about having to have a whole risk management program, right? So these small FIs aren't going to be crippled with that level of compliance. And at the same time, in the same way that Starlink has expanded internet access to rural America in ways that have never existed before. By the way, that's my internet provider. I live in rural America, and I had a horrible internet before that. Open banking extends that technological experience to very technological savvy people who don't live in New York City or San Francisco, right? And expect that level of integration. I live in cattle farming area. The amount of technology that has come into traditional farming is somewhat insane. It's amazing to watch. And so these younger generations want technology while they continue to live in the traditional landscape. And so open banking really empowers that. So even those small institutions, at least on the technology side of the rigs, I see are going to veer into this really quickly, or they're not going to exist, right? That's really where it comes down to.
The other thing adjusted in the final rule relative to the previous draft was the tiering structure, indicating which financial institutions are covered. There used to be 4 tiers, now there are 5, but of particular note is the wholesale removal of those with less than $850 million in assets. The draft rule included them, aiming to cover almost the entire U.S. market, 10,000 institutions. But now, over 80% of U.S. banks and credit unions, many of whom you serve, are out of scope. What are your thoughts on that decision?
Look, it's the same. I think we're going to live in a very competitive market. Some of the most innovative financial institutions I've come across in my time at Fiserv have been some of the smallest institutions in the country. They've specialized in areas that have been forgotten by some of the larger or medium-sized financial institutions. They serve communities that are important to the fabric of this nation. So from that perspective, I think while I appreciate probably the intent behind the CFPB to kind of diminish the weight of this ruling for some of the smaller institutions, they're some of the scrappiest that I know of. And I believe that they will be at the forefront of change as much as some of the largest financial institutions out there. And they will continue to push the envelope in terms of innovation. Because as it was said earlier, if they don't, they're at risk of being consumed.
Right. Even in the absence of regulation.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And our answer is the same, right? For those banks who don't have to comply, it is in their best interest to do it, to compete. Now, if I think about why many of the newer fintechs exist, and have built incredible products, are making real impacts for end users, are solving real needs, the reason why most exist is because there was an unmet need across many different user journeys that someone was either ignoring or didn't have the line of sight to. And so what I think open banking allows for those banks to really sort of do is to have a network of partners who can help assess and also deliver on unmet needs within the market. That is a fundamental sort of construct that is not going to go away. And today's consumer, tomorrow's consumer will continue to demand more, because so much of what is expected in banking has nothing to do with banking in terms of the experiences, the ease of use, the access to your data, the control of your data. And so banks have to get engaged regardless of whether the rule says you have to do it or not.
The smaller FIs really are, I like your term, scrappy. That's a great word for it. The other thing is they can win on service well beyond what a large FI can, and they know their community. So the goal and the rule will help them. They can continue to focus on that service. They'll know your name when you, the rare occasions you have to walk in the door because something really went wrong or you have some really big need, they'll know who you are and be able to help you there. But at the same time, we can open up the entire ecosystem of the U.S. financial system far beyond their size available to them just because of the open banking concepts and regulations. And yes, I think the majority of them, I think they're going to be picked up and pulled along just because their provider offers it, right? And they're, of course, going to adopt it. But I think they're going to win for the fact that they're not required to. And so they can worry about more pressing needs in the short term and just come along for the ride. And it's critical that they succeed, right? That's, you talked about 80% of the FIs being below that tier. We want them to succeed. We need them to succeed. The U.S. economy depends on them. So they're very important. It's just excluding them from the rule, I think, was just a eyes wide open, realistic approach.
So adopt open banking because your consumers want it, not because the regulation is making you do it.
I would say demand it.
That's right.
In adopting open banking, data providers have many choices. They can build, they can partner, they can buy. Even within the buy option, there are many different types of providers out there ready to assist FIs to get ready for Section 1033. Aggregators, API management vendors, iPaaS platforms, and of course, core banking providers. Are your organizations aiming to provide open banking capabilities that will support your customers in getting ready for Section 1033? I think we've already heard the answer is yes. And if so, is there a good reason for them to use their core provider instead of one of the other categories?
Look, there's been a lot of media attention over the last couple of months to third parties that were attempting to broker interfaces between fintechs, gig platforms, third parties that needed access to core banking data without coming directly to the core banking system provider. And I think those lessons have been well documented. I think for us, the reason we feel that we have a responsibility to support the open banking standards and to enable these capabilities is not just because we're the core banking provider and the tech provider behind the scenes, but we also are as regulated as our financial institutions are. And because of that, I feel that we are the only folks that can do this in an appropriate way, in a commercially responsible way, that allows the financial institutions to have the confidence that when they then extend those capabilities to their consumers, they're doing it in the best way possible.
Yeah, and I'll say it again, there are incredible companies, incredible fintechs out there building amazing solutions that are solving real pains in a marketplace. I think for us, if you think about how our clients, our banks shop, right? They have multiple products with us. We have clients from the credit unions all the way to your top 10 banks who are leveraging us for their core platforms. They're leveraging us for money movement, our debit rails, wires, ACH, our wealth platforms, our capital market solutions. And so while working with a provider directly does allow you to solve particular needs within sometimes particular products, because we provide a breadth of solutions to our banks, the power we bring is the scale, it is the security, it is the management of risk throughout our history that I think banks come to us for, but it's the ability to build them once and deploy across a broader ecosystem of solutions they get from us anyway. And so working through the core provider does allow for that benefit. And again, for us, we are building, and we have started building and are rolling out easier interfaces for our clients who have multiple solutions with us, so that when they want to bring a third party or a fintech provider to the table to create the bespoke experience, we can support them very quickly with the highest level of quality wrapped around risk and compliance and security that they expect.
So I think from the technical side, it's not going to be the core providers, it'll be the digital banking providers, but most of us have both. So the digital banking providers will be the easiest, right? And the tightest integration, right? We'll support it on their behalf, and it'll probably be the most commercially feasible. It'll work the best. It'd be the easiest journey for the FIs. Where this gets interesting is on the compliance and risk management side for that third-party intake. And so I don't see core digital banking providers in mass signing up to do all that due diligence for all of their FIs. Maybe they will. Jack Henry is definitely not looking at that. So I think there's a lot of third parties who can provide that kind of intake process, because some FIs are simply not going to want to staff up to support that. What's really unknown, though, is how many are going to be coming, right? So if the platforms already support the major data aggregators, how many are going to be coming direct for every FI out there, right? Is it going to be a flood or a trickle? We don't know. If it's a trickle, they could probably manage it. If it's a flood, there's no way. And so I think managing that risk and intake process and due diligence process is probably the most interesting place where third parties can really move in and assist with there. I think we're all just in a wait and see mode right now to see how this is going to shake out.
Regulated open banking in the U.S. has now left the station. Let's close with a simple question. Will your organizations be ready to meet the deadlines?
Yes.
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 Gentlemen, thank you for a wonderful discussion. It's been hugely informative.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
The road to regulated open banking in the U.S. has been nothing short of a roller coaster, full of twists, steep climbs, and the occasional stomach-churning drop, especially in more recent months. The regulatory landscape is shifting. Section 1033 looms large, and the demands on financial institutions, especially smaller ones, can feel overwhelming. But through it all, the big three core providers are staying the course. Not because regulators say they have to, but because the consumer demand is undeniable. The need for seamless, secure, and universal access to financial data is no longer a distant vision. It's here today. People now expect their banks to work with other banks, to talk to fintech apps, to become part of their digital lives. And they expect this from small banks just as much as from big ones. As open banking standards begin to level the playing field, the right technology from the right provider can empower smaller institutions to punch well above their weight, remaining competitive in a rapidly evolving market. When the U.S. cores look at open banking, they don't just see a regulatory burden. They see a way to help their customers compete and thrive in a digital world. Ultimately, whether driven by deadlines or demands, the big three won't just be ready. They'll be leading the way. Thanks for listening to Mr. Open Banking, the podcast that explores the ongoing evolution of open banking and its impact on our lives. Make no mistake, the rise of open banking is going to change financial services forever, and we will be covering that story every step of the way. This is your host, A.L. Savan. Until next time. This episode of Mr. Open Banking was made possible by Ozone API, providers of the only API platform that supports every open banking standard in the world, unlocking the power of open finance. To learn more, visit ozoneapi.com.